You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 23rd of April 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting live today at radioalbion.com, because we have with us the geopolitical analyst that is known as Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good afternoon to you, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm just very pleased that we live in an environment now where my antisocial tendencies are now considered a virtue. So this has been a big deal for me over the last month.
I think the same goes for myself as well. My rather antisocial tendency, spending all my time making podcasts. It's interesting to see, isn't it, how the rest of the world gets on with living the life of a nationalist podcaster. But they don't actually make the podcast. I get that. I guess that is the difference. We're going to be talking again about one of the effects of this coronavirus has actually been the oil price to crash, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the oil industry today. Do you want to just mention something about that oil industry crash before we get into this, and how and the effects with Iran, Matt?
Well, the oil industry was heading towards a crash anyway, because of the price war between Saudi Arabia and Russia, which, by the way, Saudi Arabia started. They issued a 10% discount back in late January. Well, I shouldn't say that, early March, before this really hit hard. And they went back and forth for a while. Then Corona hit, 2 weeks later maybe? And then people there are dumping contracts all over the place because they can't take delivery. So now it's crashed beyond belief. The worst part of all of this is a war with Iran may make more sense economically than a war with China. Because a war with Iran would probably wipe out Saudi Arabia's capacity and cut, of course, Iran off entirely, which is exactly what American oil producers really want to see. They want to see a massive crash in production, which, of course, would keep them in business. So this is terrifying at the moment because it is in their economic interest for a war with Iran right now. And we know how powerful oil is in Washington.
So we were talking last week that there may be war with China, there may be war with Russia, but actually it looks more likely it will be with Iran because of the effect that it will have on the oil prices. Well, it's not just us talking about this, of course. It's also being talked about on Russia Today. It's believed that a US-Iran war would disrupt the flow of Middle Eastern oil and as such should be avoided at all costs. With US oil futures trading in the negative, has the risk of such a war suddenly become attractive? Last week, nearly a dozen Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy vessels harassed a formation of US Navy and Coast Guard ships operating in international waters in the northern Persian Gulf. According to the US Navy, approximately 11 Iranian fast patrol boats conducted dangerous and harassing approaches of a flotilla of 6 vessels, repeatedly crossing the bows and sterns of the American ships at high speeds. Such maneuvers are not uncommon in the Persian Gulf, where the US and Iranian navies have faced off against each other several times over the years, employing similar harassing tactics, but always stopping short of actual confrontation. And I'll just stop there. And there are two points here that I'd like to make. Number one is the Persian Gulf. Once, and we talked about last week about the South China Seas, and it's America in the Persian Gulf. And the second point that I want to make is it says that these Iranian boats were fast patrol boats. And obviously they're going to be going faster than the US Navy battleships. And when you're at sea, the fastest boat steams ahead of the slowest boat. You don't just all hang around behind the slowest boat. If you can go faster than them, you will go faster than them. I mean, you're at sea, aren't you? It's like, you know, skiers going down a mountain. They overtake one another. They go behind one another. It's just the way that things happen. I don't think there's anything out of the ordinary here at all. And I think that's what the report is actually saying. What do you make of this, Matt?
I just watched the video that the Iranian government put out to RT and a few other places, showing exactly what happened with these ships. And they maintained their distance. It was an American warship, but it did have spy equipment on it. They could tell just by the signal that they get from it, and it did turn back. These are actually speedboats with maybe a 50 caliber machine gun on them. These were not, you know, major warships, but by any means, or missile cruisers at all. And they have the whole thing on video. And for the U.S. to be – we talked about this a bit last week – for the U.S. to be, you know, frightened that these boats are, you know, running rings around them is ridiculous. It's just a way to start a war. And the Iranians, again, this is their territory. It's called the Persian Gulf for a reason, have every right to do what they're doing. And their restraint has been nothing short of heroic.
Well, if they're in the international waters as well, I mean, there's nothing to say that a boat can't come alongside you, overtake you. You know, it's not you mustn't overtake any other boats that are in the sea. I mean, there's just nothing to this. It's just complaints about normal behaviour from speedboats. I would suggest it's just that these happen to be naval boats from Iran. As such, President Donald Trump's tweet on Wednesday instructing the US Navy to shoot down and destroy any and all Iranian gunboats if they harass our ships at sea seemed like an unnecessary and dangerous escalation, especially given the history of the US-Iranian confrontation in the region and the potentially devastating consequences of such. Almost immediately after Trump released his tweet, the price of oil rebounded. Futures contracts for West Texas Intermediate spiked to $11.49 after previously dropping to historic lows, bottoming out at nearly negative $37. Likewise, Brent futures, which benchmark around 60% of global crude purchases, jumped $1.20 higher to $20.53 per barrel after trading as low as $15.98. Normally, the cause and effect relationship between the threat of war and the rise in oil prices would be viewed in a negative light, but these are not normal times. So do you think Donald Trump was surprised by this? Do you think this was planned by him, that, you know, by making a comment that was against Iran and could have sparked off like a war with them? Do you think he knew that this was going to cause the oil prices to go back up again, Matt?
You know, he's enough of a businessman to know that this has happened many times before. It goes from a negative number and it actually spikes. This West Texas Intermediate and the Brent, those are two methods of pricing very high quality oil. And so they're the standard benchmarks. But if this is what his definition of harassment is going to be, and he stays close to his promise, then war is absolutely certain. And it seems the worst part about this is how oil, I mean, it went back down again, but oil temporarily rebounded a huge amount just by talk of this kind of war. In other words, this is what American producers want to hear, and because they were heavily indebted to begin with, and now especially the smaller firms are going out of business. He could simply, you know, put up tariffs, which he claims he may do, or this war, which could, again, you know, we've been talked about, you know, blaming the economic downturn on this stuff, and unifying the country and having this enemy that no one knows anything about. But I do think Donald Trump constructs this Iranian nation as this third world backwater. Little does he know that this is a first world country that will use its intercontinental ballistic missiles to knock the U.S. Navy out of the water. This is not a third world country he's messing with here, and it's a first world country, and with a very strong, motivated army. But at least in the short term, this is what American oil producers want to see.
It's a huge country. It's an absolutely massive country. I think, you know, it's the size of Turkey or larger than Turkey. I'm, you know, amazed at the size of it, because you don't really realize that it's that large. But I'm also just amazed that with a simple tweet from Donald Trump, he can cause the oil prices to increase by 25%. I mean, that is some tweet, that is, to cause that to happen. In a time of pandemic, the US prepares for war, but Iran's weakness is grossly exaggerated. The US is preparing for confrontation with Iranian-backed militias in Iraq, while Iran struggles to cope with the consequences of the coronavirus inside its borders. This looks like a good time for the Americans to strike, but actually it isn't. The US military is engaged in a strategic redeployment of forces inside Iraq, including the deployment of surface-to-air missiles, whose only logical purpose was to defend against an Iranian ballistic missile threat. This movement of forces has reinforced concerns that some in the Trump administration might seek to exploit Iran's perceived weakness brought about by the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. The reality, however, is far different. Iran is prepared to defend itself using the totality of its defense resources. Any US move against Iran would be a miscalculation with devastating results. And I think what they're saying there is because of the military capabilities that Iran has. But I would suggest that also, I mean, if they, you know, they can't really use Iraq as a platform for this. The last time they tried to do anything against Iran, the Iraqis all voted to kick all the Americans out. I mean, what happened to that? I mean, surely the Iraqis would rise up. It wouldn't just be Iran that America would be fighting against.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, Iraq is almost a majority Shiite country. Not quite. And these militias are very large and very popular. And don't forget, in the rural areas, they're taking over, like they are in the West Bank, a lot of social services. So these are popular. They would have to fight at least two countries and see massive boycotts of their products worldwide. Not to mention, Russia's going to be assisting the Iranians with all kinds of tracking and intelligence and things like that. I think Donald Trump just has this notion of these you know, goat herders. Incapable of fighting, and he's in for a rude awakening. I think the American foreign policy establishment still thinks Iran is a third world country, but using Iraq, as you say, is a disastrous idea. I guess they've ignored so much for democracy. I guess they've ignored what you know, the demand that they lead the country. So it is a colony after all.
Well, clearly, isn't it? I mean, there was a majority vote. The Americans had to leave, and the Americans just ignored that majority vote. Well, Iran has emerged as the epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak in the Middle East. As of April the 1st, Iran's health ministry reported over 47,000 confirmed cases with more than 3,000 deaths. To better coordinate a response to this outbreak, the Iranian health ministry announced the formation of a national coronavirus combat and prevention headquarters, which has deployed 30,000 teams operating under the supervision of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps to help in combating the outbreak. The severity of the COVID-19 outbreak in Iran has been interpreted by some policymakers inside the Trump administration as proof that the ongoing campaign of maximum pressure based upon the application of stringent economic sanctions has succeeded. These same individuals, whose ranks include Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien, have cited widespread demonstrations in both Iran and Iraq as additional proof of the level of discontent that exists regarding Iran's theocratic government. Well, the demonstrations that I remember is millions of people out there furious at America for assassinating Soleimani. And just who's speaking the truth here, Matt? Is it Mike Pompeo, or is it the millions of people that appear to be supporting the Iranian government?
Every time Mike Pompeo, I think, is incapable of saying anything true. He's well aware that if there's any protest against the Iranian government, it's that they're not being hard enough against the Americans. It's that they're being perceived as weak. That these are militants. They're well aware that the economic problems that they're facing are at least partly caused by some of these sanctions, especially on finances. Now, most countries are ignoring this, but it has hurt them to some, especially in the banking industry. It's really the only place that these sanctions really work. But that's what these demonstrations. You see a demonstration of elite, you know, school kids with their signs in English, you pretty much know who's behind it. But overwhelmingly, these are Persian groups with Persian language signs, and most of them, we can't read them. But most of what this is saying that the government's not being militant enough against it. These are very vehement anti-American demonstrations. They burn the flag, the Israeli flag, the American flag. And so these guys, again, they're constructing an enemy. They're not reflecting reality. They're constructing, they're projecting what they want onto these demonstrations.
Well, surely there would also be Hezbollah, there'd be the Syrian Defense Forces, maybe Russia would get involved. I mean, it really would end up escalating into a bit of a world war, I think, if America was to go in there. And don't forget, all you've got is this small American group of forces that they've actually got in Iraq. I mean, this is Iran's home territory. It would be a suicide mission if they were to do that. But apparently Trump is a hostage to internal politics as far as this oil price game is concerned. The global economy is struggling to adapt to the 1-2 punch of reduced oil demand brought on by the coronavirus pandemic and the Russian-Saudi Arabian price war, which has seen the oil markets flooded with cheap oil, threatening to drive the price per barrel to historical lows. The G20 met earlier this month in a virtual session, hello global social distancing, to try and work out a deal for universal production cuts to stabilize oil prices, and in doing so facilitate global economic recovery. While both Russia and Saudi Arabia have tentatively agreed to massive cuts in their production, such a deal is contingent upon the US making similar cuts. Domestic political realities, however, may tie President Trump's hands, killing the deal before it even gets started. The US has been riding the shale oil wave for more than a decade, taking advantage of new fracking technologies to exploit its vast shale oil reserves, and in the process propelling itself past Saudi Arabia and Russia to take the number one spot as the world's largest producer of oil. This has been a point of political pride for President Trump, who has used the notion of US energy independence as one of the key indicators of a booming economy. Any oil-derived indicator of US economic health, however, is largely illusory. Unlike Russia and Saudi Arabia, both of which have massive state-run oil companies whose operations can be dictated by the central government, the US oil industry is comprised exclusively of private corporations whose economic health is ostensibly driven by free market principles. But this free market is itself a fiction. The US fracking industry, which anchors US oil production growth, has benefited extensively from years of favorable legislation, tax breaks, and a supportive US foreign policy, which has used sanctions to restrict oil production in Iran and Venezuela to free up global market share, which has been seized by US producers. So this is clearly what Russia and Saudi Arabia are not happy about, is America steaming ahead with being the main oil producer. So that's why they've changed these prices. But what can America do about it if Saudi Arabia and Russia have actual direct control of these oil companies? And that's what it's saying here, isn't it, Matt?
I've been saying for a long time that the big difference between the Russian system of economy and the American is that in the Russian case, in the Chinese case, the government actually controls economic elites. In the US, economic elites control the government. That's what makes this frightening, because we see that if these oil companies are sufficiently powerful to get all of these tax breaks and all these subsidies and demanding right now, the shale oil firms, which have a tendency to be smaller, are spending a fortune on lobbying to get tariffs put up to have the US 100% independent of foreign oil, which it can do, except there's one small problem with that, and that is the defense industry. The defense industry, the US doesn't need to buy oil from Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia spends a fortune on American equipment, and this is the deal. Canada does the same thing. Canada's a giant oil producer. The US doesn't have to buy a penny of any of these foreign firms whatsoever, no matter who controls them. They're buying American oil. I mean, I'm sorry, they're buying Russian oil right now. People don't even know that. They bought $100 million last year. So unfortunately, again, we can go back to the same thing. A war is exactly what you need to satisfy both lobbies. It'll drive oil price up finally. It may, if it's large enough, have some economic recovery status and satisfy the defense industry all at the same time. That's the problem with putting up tariffs to boost American production, is that, well, the Saudis say, well, if you're not going to buy our oil, we're not going to buy your jets And we were, God forbid, we could go to Russia or China for that, which, guys, Turkey's done, and we all know what where that went. The U.S. needs Saudi Arabia so badly to take the place of Turkey as their anchor in the Middle East. And we all know what Saudi Arabia had done relative to Israel. This is a very delicate balancing act. And that's why the tariffs aren't going to go up. But a war, unfortunately, I'm not predicting one necessarily, because the U.S. will lose it. But a war seems to be the one option to satisfy everybody. Now, of course, the U.S. doesn't have the money, the men, the political will, or anything else to wage a war like this. But who knows? In this environment, who knows what the American population will support?
Well, isn't it also true that this fracking and this shale gas, it costs a lot more money to actually produce it than it does through the traditional ways? So Saudi Arabia and Russia, they can afford to have the price down really low, but America really can't afford that. The only way America can be the leading oil producer is if these prices are up high enough to cover the costs of producing it. And hasn't this already knocked out a load of American oil companies? Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, a bunch of the smaller, especially the shale firms, have already filed for bankruptcy protection. Now, in the Russian case, you know, I just published an article saying that Russia is not dependent on oil prices. And I'm proven right here because, you know, you have one gold mine in Magadan in the Far East that produces about half the world's supply. Russia is swimming in gold, as are the Chinese. The Turks are importing it. The Iranians are also, you know, they've never had a trade deficit. It's always been a surplus for all these countries. They have more gold than, I mean, the U.S. is envious over this. That's why it doesn't really matter what oil does. They have the gold to make sure that their currency remains stable, their economy remains stable. They have these giant funds in Russia from the good years that exist precisely for this reason. The U.S. does not have these funds. The U.S. runs at a deficit with everything it does. The U.S. is far less stable than the Russians or the Iranians are, economically speaking. And that's the most important thing to remember. Russian gold is enough to keep them afloat, even if not a penny of their oil is ever sold again. And their economy is diversified enough. And now the Iranian government's doing the same thing. They're bringing their and they have the industry and the scientific establishment to do it, to make their industry as diverse as possible, to make it as less dependent on oil as they can. So the U.S. is in trouble here. But this author is right, saying that there is no market. These oil companies control the state. Now, whether they control the state to the point of war is another matter. But and this author also goes on to say that these sanctions are really at the behest of the industry. You know, it's always oil producing countries, especially Venezuela, that's a huge competitor, and they've essentially shut that down. So that's what's happening here, and you have not only so when this is over, you'll have. Even as more pure oligarchy in oil, as the smaller firms get absorbed by the bigger ones. And as of right now, the shale industry is practically all in Chapter 11.
Well, you're just bringing up there that Russia's got all these gold reserves that they can use to back up the oil price. But I mean, just briefly, but doesn't America have all the other countries' gold? I mean, wasn't Germany trying to get their gold back from America a while back? Isn't America sitting on a huge pot of gold? Has that all disappeared somehow?
Well, how much of it do they own is another matter. The U.S. has to figure out to pay their trade deficit somehow. The gold in Fort Knox generally isn't owned by U.S. banks. Not to mention, those are privately held reserves. Those aren't state reserves like you have in the rest of the world. Those are private. Whether FDR nationalized personal gold back in the 30s, one of the first things he did, actually, but the U.S. government can't do that now. So U.S. government has zero. These are in private reserves. And again, I'm not entirely sure who owns these because this gold is necessary to pay down debt. I mean, the U.S. owes everybody. And so some of this gold is collateral for loans and everything else. So whatever the U.S. government has is irrelevant for that reason.
but it is actually sitting on it. Even if it belongs to other people, it is all actually just sitting there in the United States. I mean, I would guess that it could be requisitioned if necessary. But getting back to what's happening here, President Trump has intervened to the extent he can in an effort to stabilize oil prices and save the U.S. fracking industry, authorizing the government to purchase billions of dollars of oil for the U.S. Strategic Reserve, while pressuring foreign producers to make the necessary cuts in production needed to stabilize the market and allow the price of oil to settle at levels capable of sustaining US oil. The harsh reality, however, is that so long as Russia and Saudi Arabia are engaged in a price war that floods the market with oil, the price of oil will continue to fall, and with it, the viability of the US fracking industry. Trump, facing a contentious election for a second term, is desperate for a deal that will position the US for the possibility of a post-pandemic economic boom, thereby boosting his re-election prospects. He has been successful in pressuring Saudi Arabia to come to the negotiating table. While the cost to produce a barrel of Saudi oil is around $9, Saudi budgets require oil prices in the $60 to $80 range to remain in the black. But the same cannot be said about Russia, which can survive on $25 oil for up to a decade. So how's he going to pressure Russia into doing this? Ah, by lifting sanctions, possibly. Is that what's going on here, Matt?
Well, if he does, you know what the Democrats are going to say. They're going to say, we told you he was Russia's guy. So they have him over a barrel, no pun intended. But this author is absolutely correct. Russia can survive probably longer than that. And at a lesser price, because Saudi Arabia is almost entirely dependent on oil, they can't survive this. And they're going to start having to start borrowing. They're going to have to start, using these oil wells as collateral. And I don't know if there's going to be a post-pandemic boom. I don't know what the population's reaction is going to be when this is all lifted. Are they going to go on a spree, going out for the first time in a long time, something like that? It's conceivable. But I don't think the $1,200 that we were supposed to get is going to help much in that respect. But the author is intelligent here. Saudi Arabia is in a lot of trouble. They're going to have to start borrowing. But as far as the Russians can know, they have come to the negotiating table and they did work out a deal of almost 9.5 million barrel a day cut starting May 1st. The U.S., though, doesn't like the free market when it doesn't go their way and doesn't want to cut production. So the one option that Trump has is just to not buy foreign oil anymore and claim that the U.S. is totally energy independent, which is easy to do, except then, orders for a lot of military equipment and the need for U.S. military presence abroad, dissipates. Now, which is fine by us, of course, but not fine by those who run the government.
Well, if he's using American oil, that's going to be costing more than the oil that's on the actual market where it's gone to negative costs. I mean, it could be helpful. I mean, if the oil is that cheap, then yes, there could be a production boom at the end of the pandemic because oil is going to be dirt cheap and that's what everything is produced on. So, I can see there's there's a silver lining to this in that aspect. But getting back to the article, in this current crisis, Russia holds all the cards. Russia's objectives in entering this price war with Saudi Arabia were very specific, to make US shale oil producers share the pain of shrinking oil demand by engaging in reciprocal cuts in production and to leverage this pain into some sort of sanctions relief down the road. Russia's tentative agreement to participate in deep mutual production cuts was but a tease, injecting a sliver of hope into a market which reacted to the prospect, as opposed to reality, of a market adjustment. Russia has made it clear that there will be no deal unless the US absorbs its fair share of the production cuts. Trump has tried to use the nearly 2 million barrel a day reduction in oil production brought on by US fracking companies going out of business as representing the US share, but Russia has refused to accept this, citing the difference between market reality and planned production cuts. Trump, however, has no direct means available to compel production cuts on his side. Moreover, any indirect pressure, such as regulatory tightening or a halt in the federal purchase of oil, would be political suicide in an election year. So I guess to sum that up, Trump is saying, well, we've lost these oil companies, so that's our production cuts. But Putin is saying, well, no, you have to actually have these production cuts with the companies that are actually functioning. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, he's basically saying that the shale companies going out of business doesn't count, because that's not really the core of the industry. But what's Trump going to say? He can't say that our economy is so fragile that even a small cut is going to destroy the energy sector. He can't admit it's true, but he can't admit that. He can't admit the fact that big business controls U.S. government, unlike Russia. Therefore, his hands are tied. And oil money often goes to Republicans. But it goes to Republicans to the extent that they have this interventionist foreign policy, and with the circular deal with the defense industries. These are gigantic institutions, and as these smaller companies go out of business, the bigger companies are going to get bigger, because big companies can survive this kind of downturn where a small company can't. So as you get a tighter and tighter oligarchy, almost to the point of monopoly, you're going to have an extremely powerful lobbying organization. I don't see and what if the Democrats start talking about interventionism abroad, you're going to know what's going on. They're aiming for that kind of money. And Biden is an interventionist. And so, I mean, Trump could really do an America first here, and citing all of this, saying that America first foreign policy. But I don't know, with people like Pompeo around, if he's going to really do that.
Well, just briefly, Matt, what would be Trump's way out of this rather than going to war with Iran? What would be the best thing for him to do?
Tariff wall. Pull some of the American troops back. They don't need to guard oil fields anymore. Let Russia and Saudi Arabia work it out amongst themselves. Do what they can to save, especially small businesses, and here for the short term. But again, if they're going to bail out a company, that part of the company bailed out should come under public control, should be nationalized for that reason. And I just wonder, if this gets worse and worse, will pieces of the oil industry be nationalized? Of course, with all the giant compensation for the owners. But that's what I would do. But unfortunately, there's a lot of powerful people who really could use a war right now.
Well, hopefully that's what we'll see then, the nationalizing of some industries, and probably more than we would hope for, more than just the oil industry, as the outcome of this coronavirus crisis. More nationalization, more nationalist policies. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with Grandpa Lampshade. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.